In creation, when God began the process of creation, we can go back to our word last week of Bereshit, which we don't want to spend any time with, but Berosh, or with, or in the head, God created, or He established the prominent things. Now, this being said, you understand that what God does before He ever creates anything is He perfectly contemplates all the possibilities, etc., that might occur, and the possibilities are all weighed out in His mind. Now, one phrase from the rabbinic choir, if you will, is that God saw the outcome of everything. He saw the way that each one of us act and conduct our lives. And, you know, we can all stop and say, I don't measure up in this area, this way, if you want to, you know, count to things that you feel like you haven't accomplished. But the rabbis, say that He created the world anyway. So, you know, we want to, you know, pick on all of our pet sins and anyone else's and say, well, whatever. God created anyway. He knew that that it should be this way. Now, I don't intend to go back over at the present my teachings concerning the three groups of angels that are in the cosmos, and by three groups I'm now referring to the different classifications in those, which you can find in the Rambam. But you can understand that there's a group that is absolutely pro-Torah. So out of the three different classes, you'll find one group of angels that is pro-Torah. Now, their job is to see to it that the Torah, that is the cosmos, is fulfilled in exactly the pattern and design that Hashem wants. Now, if you're looking for a rabbinic address on the fact that God looked, first of all, so first of all, you know that there has to be a Torah before there's a creation. Okay? If you're not familiar with this, then you need to know that there are certain things that God created before He created the world, and there are specifics that He created, but one of the things that He has is the Torah that He created for before the world was even a beginning. In Truma 161a, in Talmud Bavli, it says that He looked into the Torah and then He created the world. So in other words, then the rabbis come along with other materials that say that the Torah is the blueprint for the world. But the Torah is not the blueprint for the world. The Torah is the world. The Torah is the cosmos. Okay, now this may seem a little bit difficult, but one of the things, I mean, I knew it would get more difficult, especially when I just got that first whiff.
Yeah, boy. And I can also watch the process.
That's even worse, isn't it?
Yeah, it's terrible.
Okay, there's cooking and challah here, so that's what I was alluding to. Okay, so in the process, God has looked into the Torah to create the cosmos. Now, specifically, we know it's the oral Torah. And the reason we know it's the oral Torah is because in Bereshit 1 and 3, very simply, it says, and God said. Okay? So, it doesn't take, you know, a rocket science to figure out that there was an oral Torah that was written or developed before the creation of the cosmos. Now, this is where it gets interesting. I think Aaron Gabriel asked a question about when we say oral Torah or nomos Torah, law, Torah, etc., are we speaking of the same oral Torah that we possess today? And the answer to the question is absolutely. It is absolutely the Torah, the oral Torah that God used to create the cosmos. Now, obviously, this will generate a few questions, right?
A couple.
So you're saying, wait a minute, Rabbi, what are you saying? You're saying that the things that he had placed in the oral Torah are unfolding now in the world around us? And the answer to that question, again, is yes, absolutely. So the thing is, for example, let's say Elon Gariel gets up on Sabbath morning and is going to teach a lecture, or whenever he has his weekly lecture with the congregation, he gives a lecture. Is that oral Torah? It's absolutely oral Torah. Is that a part of the oral Torah?
Yes.
When you say, okay, you show me in the oral Torah where it says this, 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 and this, that so-and-so said in their lecture, everybody's, you know, saying like, you know, chapter and verse, but guess what? Now, here's the real kicker, right? The Torah, written Torah, was not generated in such a way that it was a standalone piece of text. Therefore, you know that there has to be an emendation to the Torah, as it were, for you to understand the pieces of it that don't seem to be absolutely clear, or absolutely pshat, or any of the other levels that you want to discuss. So you look at it, and so you know that built into the mechanism of the Torah is the fact that you have to have a teacher to teach you the Torah. It's as plain as black and white. That's how it is. Now, don't, you know, start thinking just because now we got the oral Torah that everything should be written in the oral Torah as well. It uses the same exact mechanism as the written Torah. Or actually, we should say, the written Torah follows the mechanism that is established as a protocol in the oral Torah. It has to be elucidated by a teacher, when I'm saying teacher, it might be you having a cup of coffee with some guy at the donut shop and having a conversation about the Torah. It's still as much a piece of the oral Torah as adding the oral Torah or combining the oral Torah and the written Torah are the same thing. Does everybody understand what we're saying? Everybody good, okay?
Well, from the standpoint of that each person writes his own Torah.
Absolutely.
From another perspective, it's a little difficult to see, or you could certainly see how people might get into error regarding this train of thought.
This is true, but again, here we understand that everything has to still fit within the boundaries of rabbinic authority, okay? And as His Eminence will jump up and down and holler and scream and yell. We're not talking about despotic authority saying, you got to do it my way or the highway. That's not what's being said. But all of us can equate to the tzaddik that His Eminence is in the way that He teaches Torah. Most of the time, if you err in presenting your information to the class, for example, on Sunday morning, His Eminence doesn't say, no, 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 no. He doesn't do that. He said, yeah, but what you're trying to say is... And so rather than it being, you know, some harsh ridicule or otherwise, His Eminence just kind of guides and steers the lesson in the way that the lesson is going, or he tries to direct the class. So the other thing that we need to understand, so let's, for example, now I just cited or paraphrased Teruma 161a. So now, you remember the libraries, and I think our library probably still has this. I haven't been in a while. Remember, you know, used to go to that little index card thing? It's got a million little index cards in it, and, you know, if you want to look up a book, you look in that goofy thing and see if it's there.
It's computerized now, I think.
Yeah, it's probably all computerized now.
It is. Our
library is that way?
They got rid of their card catalog.
Wow, we're really moving forward.
Well, I think they're still there. I just don't think people use them the same way anymore.
I gotta say, it helped when everybody on the board for the library finally had a library card.
Very good. Okay, so if you were to go and look for a particular book, you know, it could be alphabetical, it could be topical, however you want to do it. Okay, let's just suppose that you're going to do something semi-topical. For example, you know, we open up to Berachot in the Mishnah, Berachot 1:1, from what time in the evening do you recite the Shema? Okay, if we were to give a lecture on the Shema, and let's suppose you go to the academy in the heavens, and you're looking through the index of all the lectures that are available, or all the material that's available on the reciting of the Shema, how many cards do you think you would go through if it included even the lectures that we're given right now? But, and this is what it says about Yeshua, right? But understanding this, it will not be the world, the end, as it were, will not come until the final word of the Torah, oral Torah, is said. So each one of us have our little dance, have our little piece to say, to sing, etc., whatever it might be, and we contribute to that oral Torah as long as... Well, we contribute to the oral Torah, and it can be either positive or negative. You can have those that say, we don't believe in that oral Torah business, and on and on and on. And I say, how foolish, because no one who says that the oral Torah or the teachings of the rabbis is of no consequence, they don't have any freedom. No freedom whatsoever. If you have to get on the internet every time that you have a halakhic question, then you are not free. But what you can learn to do in a true congregation is say, let's say the rabbi says on Fridays we have to put on a red wig. And you say, thanks, you know what, Rabbi, you're pretty crazy telling us we gotta wear a red wig. Well, what do?
I'll be the one man who does not wear the red wig.
You look for a precedent.
You can look for a precedent. But let's suppose there's some slim possible chance that it could say something as silly as that. We'll just be being silly anyway, right?
And King David may have had red hair.
Yeah, okay. So, you know, David was a good...
So he wore it on Friday.
Nice. See there? Boy, that master's degree.
Just kicked in, didn't it? Bring on the cape.
No, there it is. Class over. That means Ronald McDonald is...
No, I'm sorry. Wait.
I'm sorry.
Different
thing. Ian McDonald.
Kosher and crazy.
That was too Kabbalistic. I'm sorry.
All right. So, what do you do? You say, okay, the rabbi's crazy, but we're going to do it. And so, when God gets you... before the judgment seat, said, "Now listen, I got a bone to pick with you. Did you wear a red wig on Friday?" And so that's what the rabbi told us to do. So God's going to say, "Okay, you're excused." Now who's going to get the axe when you get in front of God? What were you doing telling these people to wear a red wig on Friday? David.
Hope it's not somewhere between.
I hope I'm that smart.
I hope it's not somewhere between Tammuz and Ob, or you're in trouble. He's already not happy with Aquaman right now.
You hear that? Dr.
Hill's phone. Okay. So, basically, what I'm saying is that to learn to rest in the fact that any rabbi that wants to, even if he's just a wannabe rabbi like me, he's not going to say, you know, do this or do that without deep conviction or precedent or otherwise, because I'm not that silly. I may be crazy, but I'm not that crazy. Okay? So you understand that, boy, we just lost everybody. Hopefully they'll all come back.
I don't think I like your bit about the revolution.
That was what it was. Come
Rabbi Ronald. That ain't kosher.
Just trying to connect. Maybe we'll pick back up. Okay, so that being said, you know, there has to be, and I'm not saying this about myself, I don't want anybody to get to that place to think that, but there has to be a place where you come to trust in the leadership, and if you don't trust in the leadership, then undoubtedly there's something wrong and needs to be worked out. But I only say that because for me personally, my interaction with His Eminence is one of absolute trust. His Eminence, he will never steer you wrong. And many times in our discussions, I usually kind of, you see me on Sunday morning, I kind of keep my head down a little bit and I'm taking my notes. Well, the whole deal with keeping your head down and taking the notes is the fact that I'm going to try to redo this because I think it's messed up. Is because I want to reap what I sow. I want to reap what I sow. And so I give what I want in return. Okay. Everybody good with that? Do I need to discuss the oral Torah as a cosmos any farther? Oh, absolutely. But are we going to do
Torah? I want to finish the three groups.
Pro Torah. Number two is angelic
rivalry,
and angelic rage. Rivalry is because of the Torah. Rage is because God created man with the ability to sin. Anyway, he knew he was going to sin. He said, I'm going to make him anyway. And that's exactly what he did. Okay? So keeping that in mind.
So the angels were enraged at what God did.
With decided to create man? Yeah. And this,
with the ability to sin.
With the ability to sin. And here they are, pure spiritual being. And no.
And we've been, have the potential to be elevated above them.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, that being said, the point when the angelic rage begins, and this is, I'm going to use a phrase that we all used to, okay? Between Genesis 1 and 2, there's a gap. Everybody understand that?
Gap 3.
Yeah, there's no gap. Okay, so really, we need to throw the idea of the gap out. And it's just, chronologically, that's how it works out. It doesn't have to be, this is 1, this is 2, this is 3. or this happened at 105, 110, etc. It doesn't have to be that way specifically, because that's not the nature of the Torah. The nature of the Torah is not chronology or chronological cessation. The topical thing is much more the case. And it's very interesting that it follows sometimes a very topical thing, because when you read the Mishnah or the Oral Torah, any of the Oral Torah, it's amazing, because what happens is it goes to the Torah, to the written Torah, or vice versa, and what it does is it lifts out a piece of text. And when it lifts that piece of text out, c'est la vie to previous context of what that verse was, it's now in an entirely new context. It's in the Mishnaic or the Oral Torah, the context that it would give to us. Okay? So these are the three groups. The one pro-Torah. Now if you look at this, and then you put Judaism in the equation here, you got a big problem, right? Two-thirds of the angels are against the Jewish people. So no wonder we suffer all the harassment we do in the cosmos.
So why are they rivalry? Why is the
rivalry is because we got the Torah. Here's because we were created to begin with the capacity to sin. Here, we get the Torah away from them, and they're jealous because we have the Torah and they didn't get the Torah. Yeah.
Clouds of glory.
Etc.
Very interesting perspective they have from the Midrash.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because the Torah was given to the Jews. It's not just given to everyone.
No,
it's
no, no.
Given
yeah.
to the Jews, and
exactly.
That's why the two.
Here are the rages against. Rage. Here are the rages against humanity.
Yeah.
So right. When we see the angelic rage against humanity, the light bearer, the one who was called the light bearer, who fell. Okay, let's look at this. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, darkness. And the beginning wasn't dark, but now darkness has come. Okay, and then you look in verse 3, he said, not let there be light, but let the light that is continue to be. Okay, because, and then it says, now this is difficult to do, but let there be light, and there was. Now, help me grammatically, because I don't know how to fix this, but the problem is, it is in the past tense. There is a light that was that is not now. Okay? And so here we're talking about the Or HaGanus, or the primordial light. Okay? Which is seen from time to time in various scriptures. Of the Talmudim, which one of the disciples, which one sees it first?
John?
See
here.
Oh, Peter. Oh. Man, it's good for us to be here. This is a good place to be. Let's build three Sukkot. Right? And he sees Yeshua. And he sees Messiah. But when he sees Messiah, he doesn't see Yeshua. He sees all of Messiah. Okay? And when you figure that out. Okay? So, this is where he's working with that. And then at that point, what happens is the light bearer falls. Okay? He becomes the leader of the rebellion against humanity. And then there has to be a new light bearer, right? And who is the light bearer? The Master. He says here, the Spirit of God hovered over the face of the waters. Okay? What he's doing is he's already in the process of starting Tikkun, or initiating Tikkun. Okay. That said, let's go to page.
Moments.
Yes, sir.
Are you saying creation was broke before we ever got hold of it?
It was broke before we ever came on the scene. There's too many passages. There are passages, subtle passages, to discuss what happened prior. It's just a matter of putting the pieces of the puzzle together. All right, we already discussed on page 40. We've already discussed the fact that the language is indicative of on page 40, we show that who he's speaking of or speaking to is most likely a recent convert. Now, going to page 41, we discuss what is called the paraclete. Is everybody familiar with the phrase paraclete? Perhaps not you. In Christian circles, there is an awareness of the fact that the word paraclete is a comforter. And it occurs five times in the Nazarene Codicil. And it's almost always a reference to the Ruach HaKodesh or the Holy Spirit. Okay? So you can write that down because we're gonna attack that problem.
Not parakeet.
Yes, you're absolutely correct.
Nor a pachyderm.
Not a pachyderm either.
Alright.
When we look at the soul, common knowledge in Judaism that the soul is comprised of five different levels. The first level is nefesh, the second level is ruach. Now, let me do this because I'm going to butcher some cows.
Make sure the knife is sharp.
Yes, sir. No dicks, etc., right?
Exactly.
Nefesh is the base level of the soul. It's the point of interaction, or it's an interface to the physical body. Okay, the physical, in other words, this is the point where that there's an awareness that you're alive. And that you're somehow connected to the meat. Okay? Say again?
I think therefore I am.
I think therefore I am. And then you say, I am what I am.
I am what I am, and I love yams.
Okay. But I do not. Love yams. But I am what I am.
It's all that I am.
That's it. All right. So This will be the physical interface to let us know that we are in fact alive, etc. Then we come to the level of the ruach, and then the ruach, here I'm speaking of the base level of the ruach, or I'm speaking of general terms of the ruach, okay? Now,
the breath.
This is my hand. We'll get there in a minute, okay? Misham is more associated with the breath than ruach, but ruach is associated with the breath as well. Yeah, we'll see if we can clarify, okay? So we come to the ruach, you know, I can say, this is my hand, okay? this is my finger, which is still a unit of the hand. Okay? Mm-hmm. So you can identify all the fingers and all the bones in the hand or whatever, and you can say this is whatever it is and on and on and on, but it's still the hand. Okay? So now when we talk about the Ruach, also we can come to the place that we can dissect in some respects the Ruach. Some years ago, there was a man named Watchman Nee, which I don't know if any of you read his writings. I know what O'Neill has.
I have.
You have? Very good. Watchman Nee, he ministered some 30 years before he was incarcerated by the Communist Party, Chinese Communist Party. And he died. He died in 1972 in prison. He was supposed to be in prison for about 15 years, and he was supposed to be liberated. It never took place, and he died in prison. But he was a very prolific writer, and he had a very, very strong awareness of the spiritual world, and he wrote considerably along those lines. Now, think that much of that material is a little bit archaic, only because now greater revelation has come, and we can still use the base models of what he said in many cases, but only with, you know, some
modification
and an understanding. Okay, and he was very aware of this. But later, in more contemporary times, a man named Randy Shankle came. Now, Randy Shankle came based on what he learned from Watchman Nee and some others that prior to him, and he divided the soul and the spirit and discerned and said the soul and the spirit were two different things based on Hebrews 4:12, etc. And he called the teaching merismos. But the difficulty with his teaching is he failed to see that this is the hand, and this is still the hand, and this is still the hand, and this is still the hand, etc. He failed to understand that, yeah, the differentiation between the soul and the spirit is only for the sake of clarity and for understanding. If I say this is my thumb, you know that it's my thumb, but you know it's still a piece of my hand, okay? Because it can't be separated, or it's non-functional, okay? Absolutely.
Part of the hand,
all the way to about the wrist.
Right.
Okay, so what I want you to understand is that there's been a greater awareness in these past decades of the Ruach and spiritual things. Now, looking on the Jewish side, you take men like Luzzatto and Rambam, and etc., and their discussions and illuminations on the spirit and the spiritual man, it's a very, very obviously very, very difficult or a deep subject. But one of the things that we should be learning and coming to a greater awareness is that it is becoming more and more prevalent, the understanding and the deep understanding, Kabbalistic, Zoetic understanding is growing every day. And then we should see and understand that that's a process that God wants us to have because we're coming closer to the kingdom, okay? So the closer you are, for example, in your years of maturity, the closer you are to the other side, then especially when time gets short, you're more aware of that world than you are this world, and you seem to have a propensity to want to be there much more, okay? Now, the next, I'm going to upset the apple cart. The Ruach HaKodesh. How do you get out of this?
I don't know, my apples are pretty upset.
Number one, Judaism does not hold a Trinitarian idea of Father, Son, Holy Spirit. okay? All of us here, that's a no-brainer, right?
It's not Avben and Ruach?
No, it's not.
Just not even that. Just wanted to clarify. Just wanted to put it out there and make sure.
So, if Yeshua says, as the Torah says in the Nevi'im, God is going to give us the Ruach HaKodesh, there has to be a Ruach HaKodesh. Now, to define this in a multitude of other terms is one thing. We can understand that you could say, and you, in some places it's appropriate to translate as such, the Nefesh Yehudi. Okay? But usually when we have to use Nefesh Yehudi in as far as being a recipient of the Nefesh Yehudi, we're talking about the Gentile who receives that spirit. When he receives that spirit, then he has got now the Ruach HaKodesh. He has now the spirit of holiness within inside of him. For the Jewish people, they always have and always will have the Ruach HaKodesh or the Holy Spirit. And this connects itself with the higher functions of the Ruach, because here now you have here an interface between here and the body, and then here you have an interface between the spiritual and your awareness of spiritual and the upper regions of spirituality through the Ruach, and the Ruach HaKodesh is the level that is that level where that now the interface has been connected. The interface has been connected with the upper realm, and it's engaged itself, and the engagement now draws down information from above.
So,
wait a second.
Is this whenever the people of Israel said, Ma'aseh HaNishma, is that when it was instigated? When they said, we will do and we will hear, is that when the Ruach HaKodesh was actually... not that it wasn't there already, but that at that time that it was actually initiated into action?
I don't believe that. I'd say
I'm
it has
asking,
to be...
I'm not saying it is.
I understand that you're not saying it is. I know, as a matter of fact, when we spoke the other day at the graduation, we said that Shem is the father to the sons of Eber. And that's a very problematic saying, because if you want to translate it, he's their ancestor, that's okay, but it doesn't need to be stated because it's a common knowledge. You can look at any genealogy and you can see the genealogy and said he was the ancestor. So the Torah doesn't waste words on things that it's not trying to wave a flag at. So when it says he is the ancestor, that's not what it means. It said he's the father of the sons of Eber. Eber is Hebrews. Okay? So it's the ones that Eber cross over. So they're the ones who it says they cross over. It's indicating they cross over, for example, the Jordan. But the point is much deeper than that. The Jewish people cross over. They can cross over into the realm of the divine, etc. So I don't want to spend a whole lot of time there, but you go back there, and the idea of the Nefesh Yehudi, the spirit that lives in residence inside of the Hebrews, is already resident in the text. So I tend to turn to Ephesians and see that it's there in Ephesians 1, which is a case for things that happened before the foundation of the world. Did God talk to you before the foundation of the world? What do you say?
Did pay attention.
Okay. Now, then we come to Neshama. Then we have Kaya. And then we have Yechida. Okay. Yechida means unity. Chaya means life. Neshama is your breath, as Gibbet, Gevorah said, but this is in no way to think of breath in just the same simple terms of the breath that was breathed into it. It's much more difficult than that. Now, if you're taking notes, I'll give you some suggestions as to some things that you need to fill in your notes. Number one, at this point, somewhere right about here, is the point where the conscious comes in. Okay? Which in me, Watchman Nee divided... One second, sir, please.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, I forgot you. I'll get to you. Nee divides the spiritual up into three components. Conscious, intuition, and communion. Okay? And we'll work that into the chart in a minute.
So that level of the Ruach would be an awareness of higher spirituality and a conduit of conduit for transmission, which would cover both the conscience, because one with a conscience has an awareness of higher spirituality, and the communion, because a conduit for transmission is how we have...
Not communion. Not yet. Okay, it will be, in a matter of saying, you could say yes, that it is, but the point of contact of the communion is on a higher level. Okay? You will receive communion here at this point, but actually communion is going to start way down here as levels of an entrance into the soul.
What did you say that Yechida was?
Yechida means unity.
Unity.
Okay. So, then here at Neshama is where the intuition or the intuitive part of man is going to start functioning. And then in Chaya and Yechida, more in Chaya than Yechida, because Yechida is a very, very, very difficult level to master. And when I say master, I'm not saying that people don't have time when they make that connection, but you need to be very, very spiritually developed in order to make that connection and maintain that. Now, I realize in Jewish circles, there is some... We can dispense with it. It's not working. I don't know why. In Jewish circles, when you study the five levels of the soul, they will basically tell you that nobody is going to get even to this level right here. Okay? There is truth and there is not truth in that idea. We understand that there are basically, again, back to levels. And if we want to replicate this level on a higher plane, then yes, I can agree with them. But at the same time, God gives this capacity within us to make these connections, and they're not like a carrot on the end of the stick and say, oh, look, you could have this, but you'll never get it. Right?
Exactly. Yeah.
It's, I don't care if it's, you know, a split second of, you know, feeling or being aware of God or whatever it might be, you're brought into contact with that, and when you come into contact with that, when you come into association with that, nothing in the world can tell you that you didn't make it. You could see, someone could say, well, that's not what it was. I don't care what you call it. It's what it is.
So the real skill is, in those moments, is to learn how to capture it and hold on to it.
As much as possible. Now, I say, this is my saying, as it were, and you can throw it in the trash. I don't care. I say that this is the goal of this is to attach yourself to the consciousness of God, or your, you know, in connection and communion with God, to the place that if you have a question, let's say on a particular subject, then you seek the answer for that, and you make that connection. When you make that connection, you'll have the answer.
Okay. Well, I was just going to say, or you can look at it this way, the ability to at least move in and out
of that, you know, almost like I think of a revolving door.
Sure.
And having the ability, and I think of this in the same way, you know, people talk about tzaddik. And, you know, the Tanya says, I mean, in a way, the Tanya says to us that, you know, we can't really, you know, the regular guy, we can't, like, be a tzaddik so much, you know. And yet, the Tanya kind of says, but we should really try, but we can't. But it's, you know,
yeah.
But it's like you really have to learn how to move through these. I mean, on some level, you want to go for this. You want to say, I'm going to try to get through these passages. I'm going to try to learn to navigate this road.
Sure.
That's the gates in that you're in.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But and you can use that, but the difficulty in gates and ideas, if you understand the principles behind gates, etc., you understand that there's no such thing as a gate. It's just a point of contact where you come into that.
Right.
For example, we use a door. The door is the same thing as a gate. In other words, are we keeping the outside out or the inside in? You know, however you want to look at it. But once you pass through the door, you didn't consciously say, that was the door that had the brand new car on it. But my point is that maybe, and I'm not really being this limiting, but just as a point of illustration, you might have been in that point for a second flat. But guess what? Second flat is enough to feed information into your head that would, if it's not diffused properly through these gates again, then what's going to happen? You're going to melt down. You had a question earlier, and I keep running around.
Yes. You were saying that the Chaya and the Yechida are that there's something that both of those encompass, but it was more the Chaya than the Yechida, and you never finished.
Okay, that's the level of communion.
Level of communion.
Okay? Because you have an intuition, and this is an intuitive knowledge. It's an intuitive knowledge that okay.
It's beyond the rational.
Beyond the rational. You could sit, for example, as I do with books. You can have all the books open and you could be reading everything in the book, but it doesn't matter how much reading and what's said in the book. If you don't make the connection with intuition, you're going to keep reading the words all night long. You never make a connection.
Very
correct. Right? You see what I'm saying? So the point is that there has to be an intuitive awareness, and if you have an intuitive awareness, what will transpire is that when you finally reach the thing that you're supposed to see or you're working to see, then you'll see it.
Then an instance of that, I guess, this is a question I'm saying. When I was young and I was reading the Tanakh, I came across the story of David and how he came to be with King Saul and fight Goliath and whatnot. And from the text there, it doesn't actually tell you his age. And I was always taught that he was a child, you know, not much older than me when I was reading it. But when I read it, I knew that what I'd been told by the Sunday school teachers and stuff, I knew it was wrong. Because there's no way he could be my age and try on Saul's armor. And it's not something that had ever been told to me, but it was just intuitively, I'm like, no, they're wrong. They can't be right. Is that...
Yeah, you're right.
I'm trying to compare it with what is known in Christianity. When you get to that place where you make that connection, that's where in Christianity, where they talk about the revelation gifts, about where you can minister to other people, or you can not only know things for yourself, but you can also know things for other people, know how to pray. Even though we wouldn't call it that, like being a Christian, but yet isn't that about where it is?
Yeah, you know well that.
Hang on
a second. About 17, almost 18 years ago, I wrote a pamphlet on pneumaticals. And when you read 1 Corinthians chapter 12, it says these are the, quote, gifts of the Spirit. Number wrong, that's a massive error, because the word gifts is not there. Look for it all you want in that passage. Look for it in Greek, look for it in Hebrew. I don't care what you look for, it is not there. And it's not implied in the text. But here's how this should be read, and here's how it should be understood. Pneumaticos, always, each time you read it, will be translated spirituals. In King James, and those associated will say spiritual gifts, but if you look at it, gifts will always be in italics, telling you it's something that the translator put in here to try to do this. What this brings us to is when we read the word pneumaticos, the spirituals, in other words, it's saying these are the functions of your spiritual being. This is the things that it can do. And it's not limited to Aron Zeb gets one, Yerah Hadassah gets one, etc. They are the functions of your spirit inside. Okay? So do you know things that can only be known by having a communication with God? Why, absolutely. And do you have faith? Do you, etc., etc. Okay? These are things that are functions, not gifts. They're part of your spiritual DNA.
Standard equipment.
Everybody gets the same thing. Now, you may, in your toolbox, you may be more familiar with this gift, so to speak, or this particular function, and that's the way all of us are. Each one of us has a propensity toward this or that. And when you do that, you develop that. But that doesn't mean you don't have the other stuff in there, okay? It's all the spiritual equipment, the spiritual toolbox, the spiritual functions, however you want to say it.
But I was trying to make the connection between what we were talking about and the
revelatory functions.
And plus, that communion, like you said, the communion, like all of a sudden, just for a split second, you have a communion with God and you know that you know. Well, that's like what the Christians call the revelatory gifts, but it's really not a gift at all.
Well, the revelatory gifts come closer to Neshama than they do up to the communion, which is Yechida and Cheva. Okay, so communion is the place where, and if you've experienced it, if anyone in this room, and I know there are, so I know everyone literally is, that you've been in a place of worship, whether it be through the Siddur or, you know, Hitzbodedut, however it is that you have found a moment or a place in time to commune with God, when you found that moment of communion, it's you. I used to go from where I lived in California to Palm Springs, and we used to cross over the top of the mountain and come down into Palm Springs and work there. And so it was about an hour and a half drive from where our office or our shop was. And I had grown to a place that the thing that I wanted more than anything in my life, nothing else honestly mattered, but was to have communion with God, to be in a place of communion with God. And one afternoon, we were coming from Palm Springs, and we were headed back to our shop or our yard, and one of the Mexican young men was working with me, was watching me drive. And then he said, Walter. And I said, what? He said, what's the matter? And I said, nothing. Why? What do you think's the matter? And he goes, no. He said, you were doing something. What were you doing? And he was aware. He could feel the presence of God. He started crying in the truck riding with me. I said, what did you think? He said, I don't know. But he said, you look like a rabbit. I said, now I look like a rabbit driving down. No. He said, you look like a rabbit when it was asleep. If you know what a rabbit looks like when he goes to sleep, his eyes are open and his gaze is fixed. So it's like he's peering at one particular thing. I mean, he's not looking at anything in particular, he's just looking, okay? So this is what this young man said. He said, you were like a rabbit that goes to sleep. What that has to do with holiness, I have absolutely no idea. But what he was seeing is that...
Rabbi.
Yeah, a couple of letters, whatever you want to say. But what he was seeing is the point of connection. He saw that there was a connection, and not only did he see the connection, the young man was sitting in the passenger seat crying because he could feel the presence of God too. Now, I'm not pretending, making any holy pretense. I'm trying to make an analogy. I know all of us have had these experiences one way or another, and this is our ability. But the difficulty is to maintain or have a sustained awareness and connection with this. It's extremely difficult, and there are those who have developed that, but that's a whole other story. We need to move on. On page 44, according to the Book of Jubilees, they, the Malachim, descend from heaven at the time of Yerad, Genesis 5:15 through 20, to teach humanity to practice the Torah and justice, righteous generosity. And here we have a key to the details of how the Malach Shomer, the guardian angel, works. And now we can opine that the Malachim Hashmorim are the guardian angels and possibly the angels that teach us Torah when we're in the womb. Okay? So all of you should look below to the Talmud, where there's a piece there that we cite, and there's a piece prior where we talk, or below where we talk, it's above, I think, where we talk about the fact that the infant is in the womb. The infant is in the womb. And I said this enough times, you probably should already know. It says the Malach, he lights a candle over the top of its head, and then he begins to teach him the Torah. He teaches him the Torah for 9 months, and then, of course, when he comes out, etc. Now, the idea that the fact that the candle is lit over the head isn't for shining a light on the infant, it's to make a light for the infant to go down a path. So in other words, what the angel is doing is showing your Torah in life. Okay? This is your role. This is your responsibility. Not somebody else's. This is what I want you to do, or the training that you have for you to do your mission. So the angel always takes you down your mission. And now some people attach to this in their experiences through deja vu. Some do through dreams. Other through semi-vision, etc., they attach themselves to this. Uh-huh. Yes, ma'am.
Can we even make a connection at all to Mishlei when it talks about to raise up the child in the way he should go? Is it perhaps even, because I know that, you know, the way, the path that this Malach Shomer has shown them? Even
absolutely. Absolutely. Now, one thing I've never discussed before, interesting you brought that particular passage, is because, let's ask a question now. Where's the mom in this whole picture?
Trying to take them out.
But, what is she really thinking about in those 9 months?
What her child's going to be like.
Exactly. She is doing the same thing. She's trying to conceive the path of this child in the world.
With his headphones on the belly.
Yeah, exactly. Singing Shabbat Shalom, right?
I was saying she's dating the baby. She's molding it.
Okay. One thing that I want you to get from this lesson, there are two things, and I will try to bring them to a close very quickly. Number one, I want you to be aware of the fact that the Ruach HaKodesh is not the, quote, Holy Spirit in the Trinitarian definition by any means, but Ruach HaKodesh is part of your spiritual being, part of you that is to carry and conduct. If these are the interfaces to the, this is the interface to the physical, and this is the interface between the spiritual, etc., then what you're trying to do through this interface, these interfaces, is cause the physical to enter into an action of kiddush or kiddushah, where you're doing holy things, sanctified things. So you get up in the morning and you say the Modei Ani. You already entered into that place. You go to the wash basin and you wash your hands. You're continuing in that same spot, etc., right? And then when you try to say the various brachot throughout the day, be they, you know, whatever place that you can find to make those connections, whether it's through actually being able to say the prayers, or whether it's to say specific prayers or do particular meditations, etc. Okay? So these are connected, and it's the, this is the Ruach HaKodesh in the sense that it's the holiness of our being, and it's the best part. It's very difficult to connect on higher levels. Intuition, I will say, not so difficult, but those moments of absolute clarity in communion, they, you know, you can ask a person, say, how long were you there? In their physical awareness, they say, I don't know, maybe a second or two. But in their spiritual being, it's as if you were there for hours. I had a experience when I was about 18 or 19. I'd come to the place that I was getting cold, spiritually getting cold. And I was very, very aware of the fact that I was, and I was very aware of the fact that I needed to fix something, or it was not going to be good for me. So I started being diligent in prayer and repentance, etc. And I worked in Orange Grove with 160 acres of avocados, oranges, lemons, limes, all kinds of different fruits. I was the sole caretaker there. And they had a system, an antiquated system of irrigation. And the irrigation system was set up so that it would only water a quarter of the grove at a time, and then you would have to physically move the sprinklers from one location to the other, etc. In this time, I was even, you know, dragging a hose with water and sprinklers. I was still very much in communion with God, and my father was basically my supervisor, foreman, whatever you want to say. And when he would come onto the property to where I was at, he would always, usually, almost always take the same route. And then he would pull up the top of the location and call for me. So I was there one day pulling the sprinkler hoses, trying to make my repentance. And I heard my father call my name. And so there was like a center aisle to these trees, and he would always park to where I could see up the top of the hill and know he was there. I would come, and then whatever discussion needed to be taking place, we would discuss. So I heard my father's voice, and I ran to the center of the road and looked up the road, and no one was there. And so, you know, I was a little bit puzzled. I didn't think too much about it. I thought, oh, yeah, maybe he did come, and he just went on a little bit, or he'll come back. So I heard the voice again, heard my father again, and I did the same thing, and he was not there. And then it happened to me again, and I knew at that moment that it wasn't my father that was calling me. So I made an altar, as it were, underneath an orange tree. And when I came to my faculties, 3 hours had passed. And I saw things that can only be explained in imagery. No words, just imagery. And I've been able to communicate some of those things with my beloved, but they're very hard to articulate the idea. I said that because here's where we can come to those places of communion, and the places of communion can be even short moments, and the amount of information that comes is tremendous. It's overwhelming. Okay? Now, the reason I read this piece from the Book of Jubilees, or about the Book of Jubilees, is that it's here it says that the angels came at this time and they began to teach humanity how to practice the Torah. Now, you've heard me speak enough to understand that when I say your guardian angel, I'm not talking about the guy that sits next to you in the car when you drive 95. His Eminence has assured me that once you go over the speed limit, the guardian angel gets out. So, what I am saying is that Shomer means, this guardian angel means that what he is trying to do every minute of the day is cause you to live the Torah. That's what he wants. He doesn't care about anything else. Now back to the passage, and we'll conclude here with what Adon Zev and some of the others did. And I'm reading on page 44 from Philo, where it says Decha 181 and 87. Now, the bracket in Malek Shomer is my insertion for the sake of understanding. Now, I want you to also understand that the Ruach and the Ruach HaKodesh here is also understood as a paraclete. Okay? Everybody understands that for the most part, right? Okay, it's clear as mud, I realize. But I wanted to read this statement because I found this so powerful. And I thought that it was something that we really, really need to cling to. The conscience which dwells inside, or if this is the Malek Shomer, can you imagine that angel that taught you the Torah in your mother's womb, what he's doing daily when he comes into contact with you, trying to guide you into spiritual things, and this is the voice of him that you hear inside. And he does what? He said he never leaves the soul. Once he's assigned to the soul, he never leaves it. Of each individual, not being accustomed to admit it into itself, the wicked thing. So this is the first class of angels we discussed this evening at the begin with. He said he's not to admit himself into anything, any wicked thing. He said he preserves its own nature, always such as to hate evil and to love true virtue. Being itself at the same time an accuser and a judge, being roused as an accuser, it blames. Now, you should know that the rabbis say that the angel that gives you the Torah in the womb is also your accuser when you stand in judgment. That's not good. Because he says, what did you do with the Torah that I taught you?
I learned it.
And so he blames, impeaches, and is hostile again as a judge. It teaches, admonishes, recommends the accused to change his ways. And if he be able to persuade him, notice here how the language is changed. He is with joy reconciled to him, but if he is not able to do so, then he wages an endless and implacable war against him, never quitting himself by day or by night, pricking him and inflicting incurable wounds on him until he destroys the miserable and accursed life. Any rabbi on the planet will tell you that should you choose to live contrary to your true spiritual identity, if you could look at the physical soul of the individual who does such, there are wounds on that soul. Some of them, like physical wounds that you and I experience, that can be, in fact, healed over a period of time.
and others that leave a permanent mark. So my thesis here was, number one, the Ruach HaKodesh is paraclete to the Malach Shomer, is a paraclete in your conscience. Nag, nag, nag.